So my first question is, half a year after the killing of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police, how is the situation surrounding police brutality as of today? What successes were made by initiatives and organizations working on that topic?
Yeah, so as you kind of noted, this is about 6 months after George Floyd's killing, and actually George Floyd was killed a day before my birthday, and we've seen a tremendous amount of changes. The first thing I just want to note is that, your listeners have probably saw like the footage in America of the burning cars and the burning stores and the fights in the streets with the police between the protesters, specifically in Minneapolis, but then it's kind of stretched out to nationally and even internationally in some cases. And I think that that's definitely, an important aspect of the story. But I think that the numbers, really give you a sense of what happened here, which is what made it such a historic event. It's estimated between 15 to 25 million Americans took part in George Floyd protests in the United States. It's making it, and the protests have been continuous to this day around the country. So in any municipality, in the United States, there'll be just some anti-police brutality protest. So this is one of the largest and longest running movements for civil rights and for Black lives in the history of this country. And I think it's significant that obviously it came at a point of 2020 where we had not only the presidential election this year, but one of the worst pandemics in the history of our nation, and one of the worst global pandemics, and now obviously the COVID-19 crisis. So I think that the combination between the what happened in terms of the racial issue around race, the issue around the pandemic, and also the presidential election formed this perfect storm, and it resulted in the numbers of people that you saw protesting in the streets. And I think that what's specifically interesting about this historical juncture is that these folks these protests have been like largely multiracial, black led, but certainly like large participation by white people, large participation by Latinos, and large participation by Asians. So I think that it's really been unique in that it's also been a multiracial protest movement. And now what we've seen is that the protest movement has shifted a bit. So you still have protests. And I just want to note that the violence that's going on in the United States has not stopped. It's estimated that every 24 hours, a Black person has a violent encounter with the police, right? And this has also been added to the fact that Donald Trump, as president, has used his bully pulpit to really kind of push forward a very violent white right-wing nationalist violence in the street. So you have people like Kyle Rittenhouse, for example, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, who killed three people. He's recently got bailed out for $2 million. You have cases of this young man in Louisiana who was found dead in a swamp in Louisiana and suspected that he was a victim of racial violence. So the violence has continued, but I think what's happened is that also in the face of that violence, I think folks have really been organizing, and you see that in terms of the elections, and certainly the elections have seen a tremendous turnout. I think the highest turnout ever, at least in the past few years, and that has been a result, also a direct result of the George Floyd protest. So I think that you've seen this manifested in several ways. And I think that it's going to continue. I don't think the protests are going to stop, and I think they will continue.
So in places like New York or also like Minneapolis, there has been a discussion about something that has been like demanded under this like slogan of defund the police. And I'm hearing all this from a long distance from Germany, and it's sometimes hard to follow up on how the situation is right now. So I mean, long time nobody, like, it was really hard to talk about this in public, and now it's being discussed. So how is the situation about this demand of defunding the police in different places in the United States? And maybe you can also, in a short way and for people to understand, like, just explain what it actually, this demand, what it stands for.
Yeah, so basically the defund the police movement is a demand. It was one of the core demands of this summit. And it came out of realization that the police, we're facing a tremendous economic crisis, and we're facing a tremendous amount of austerity, particularly on the heels of the COVID-19 crisis, where you've seen millions of people unemployed. You've seen services cut. We're seeing all these type of things really dire straits. At the same time, however, you've seen the police budgets have been maintained at a very normal clip. So in New York City, for example, the police budget is close to, I believe, like $9 billion, which is like a tremendous amount of money. Earlier in this crisis, I mean, you saw pictures of doctors and nurses who are fighting COVID having to dress in paper bags and garbage bags, while the police had the newest, highest gear. In connection to defund the police is also this question around the militarization of police, right? And so the militarization of police is also included in the fact that the police have been able to buy military-grade weapons from the U.S. Department of Defense and have been using this against protesters. And so a lot of high-tech weaponry to use against civilians. And the last part I think is really important too is to think about what is the scope and the purpose of policing? I think that for a lot of people, they see policing, they see that the issue around policing, policing becomes a default of every single bad situation. So for example, if someone has a mental health crisis, somebody has some issues with domestic violence, they call the police, and the police are not trained or capable to calm down highly emotional situations, and oftentimes the only means that they are trained to use is to use force, which for most Black people ends up to be a violent encounter with the police, right? So so I think that, the defund the police movement was the same demand, saying that we should transfer some of these funds to social programs that actually deal with the underlying issues of crime. So I think that for a lot of people, we say that crime exists because there are underlying issues behind the crime, which is mostly around poverty. So if we can get rid of those issues and provide housing, provide access to after school programs, to provide, increased teacher pay, to provide social workers, then a lot of times the issues around the social crimes will decrease. And I think that's the core of the defund the police movement. I think now what's happened in 6 months of George Floyd, so what you saw was that, when there was a massive protest in the streets, a lot of politicians were very much pro defund the police. But then what happened was that I think the Republicans during the national elections and some of the local elections wanted to kind of shift the conversation back to the right. And so they started painting the picture that if you're saying defund the police, you're pro anarchy, you're pro burning cities down, you're pro that. And for a lot of politicians, particularly Democratic politicians, that scared a lot of politicians. And so a lot of politicians began to kind of try to back off. But I think that the movement demands of that are still staying, because we're not saying that we wanted anarchy. What we're saying is that if you actually put those money and put those resources into communities, then actually crime will actually go down. And so that's a different way of looking at crime fighting. If you hit it at the source, if people have jobs and they have a way of getting education, they're less likely to do crime. They're less likely to do things antisocial. So that's basically what the defund the police movement is and was talking about. And it's still a core movement. And one last thing I would say is that you cannot decouple defund the police from what's going on in America just more generally, where America has 2.2 million people in jail, and the majority of those people are Black. So defund the police is also connected to the need to shift and to abolish prisons and to really kind of build a world, think about a world without prisons, which is, I think, is another bold claim, because it's something, you know, where you just say to you on the face of it, we can't get rid of prisons. But again, it's really about getting rid of the causes of why people go to prison. And if we're spending millions and millions of dollars on jails, we can take those millions and millions of dollars spending on schools. We can spend on higher education. The United States is now, you know, there's a debt crisis in the United States right now, student debt, that that can be really shifted. And so, you know, and so in a larger scheme is also around the shifting of the values of the society to a more peaceful economy, where you're shifting from militarism to more sense of things that human beings need, particularly in this COVID-19 crisis, where, like, you know, we're 6 months into this crisis, more than that, almost a year into this crisis, and, you know, and this hasn't been too much support from the federal government in supporting people in terms of what they need to survive the crisis, particularly for those who've lost their jobs.
So you just talked about, like, the rather, like, prisons are rather working on symptoms than they're working working actually on where the problems are coming from. So I was like watching a documentary about Minneapolis in the, like, aftermath of the killing of George Floyd, and there's this monument for George Floyd, and in this area there's like this agreement within the community to not call the police in case of crimes, and there's some, like, people now policing the, like, from the community policing the area themselves. And the question, of course, was arising because also in this documentary, some people were describing the situation that you heard more gunshots at night, that you had more gang violence, and that it's kind of hard to deal with because this situation is not changing immediately. But what I was also thinking about is that some of this self-policing of this coming from the community, it kind of reminded me of the Black Panthers, what the Black Panthers did in the 60s, when they went around following police, right, and just trying to see that things don't get, like, violent, in, like, whenever there's an encounter, especially by black people with the police. Do you see parallels between this kind of things happening, what I, like, described now in Minneapolis? I don't know if there's other places where you find similar things. Do you see parallels to, like, the 60s and what the Black Panthers did?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, so first of all, I mean, like, I think historically, if you talk about Minneapolis, you're talking about the fact that, you know, during the 60s and 70s, groups like the American Indian Movement, the Black Panther Party, and particularly this group called, this Black Liberation group called the Soul Patrol, organized, you know, community policing efforts, you know, and so this issue around Minneapolis is nothing new in terms of police brutalities, particularly as it relates to also not just black people, but also Native American people as well. So I think that, you know, your historical trajectory is correct. And then, you know, there's places like Seattle to set up, like, intentional temporary autonomous zones, places like Portland. I know in New York we had Abolition Square for a long time that sought to be, like, a police-free zone. And so there's attempts by even some local immigrant groups, groups like DRUM, Deshi's Rising Up and Moving, that's a mostly South Asian group, to have what they call a harm-free zone, where, like, where you would not only, limit your encounter with the police, but also limit your encounter with the Immigration Control Enforcement Agency, which is known as ICE. So when we're talking about policing, it's not just the local police, but it's also the federal police, particularly for our immigrant brothers and sisters. You got to remember, too, there's also, you know, thousands of, like, you know, young people and parents, young people who've been separated from their parents and from the U.S. border. So that has to be also in the context of the policing efforts as well. So I think that, you know, people are trying to create their own vision of society. But I think that, you know, it's going to have a lot of different contradictions and a lot of different areas of growth, because one is that you have to really build trust within a community in order for that to work. And two, I think that it's also just a matter of, you know, retraining the people, re-socializing the people. And so when we use the kind of analogy of the Black Panther Party, it wasn't just the fact that the Black Panther Party had guns that made them like a threat. It was the fact that the Black Panther Party had books, right? And the fact that the Black Panther Party was telling black people to love themselves. That was what made them a threat. Because once you have an educated black population that's loving themselves and not self-hating on themselves, then you have the ability to have the re-socialization of our people, where our people feel comfortable with each other. You know what I'm saying? Where we feel like we can be safe around each other. There's been such a work to make black people feel unsafe with each other, right? And I think that's a result of this 40-year war that's been part of the prison industrial complex that's kind of seeped into, you know, kind of black thought in some ways. But I think that some of the people who've been activists have been doing it. And the last thing I'll say too is not just around the policing. One of the most innovative things that's kind of happened in regards to this particular moment has been around food security. The ability for activists to provide food for the community. You remember the Black Panther Party also talked a lot about food. So in a lot of areas, particularly where I'm in the Bronx, particular groups have been, putting out food distribution networks, free refrigerators, mutual aid networks to really show up when people are food dependent. And they've been the lifeline in a lot of ways, particularly in the beginning of the crisis when the government was a little slow to act to make sure that our community stayed healthy and whole. So I think that one of the terminology that we've said in years is that we keep us safe. And I think that's something that's really important. We keep ourselves safe.
So now, like, we made this kind of historic connection. So racism as a structure is something that has, like, it is a continuum. Like, it has been there since hundreds of years. It has changed in the way it works. So we had, like, the times of slavery, and then we had the Jim Crow, and we had then, like, the civil rights movement coming up, and then things shifting more to the prison industrial complex and to a different way of policing. So all the work that has been done by groups like Black Panthers and so many more, it makes me ask myself that as police violence also is not something new, especially towards black United States citizens, is there something right now that makes you believe that the protest this time, like this year, the protests that have been happening, not just with George Floyd, but also Breonna Taylor and many more. Do you feel like there's this time it's more promising than other times before?
Well, you know what? I would say this. I don't know whether or not, I think that we're at a different point right now. I'm a little bit like, I don't know whether or not. Let me put it this way, right? I think that what's happening right now is that we have a whole entire new generation of young people under the first black president who've grown up watching black people on TV as leaders. I think that there's a way in which, and I think that some of the conversations, particularly on social media, have shifted in a lot of ways. So, for example, even before George Floyd happened, there was a whole controversy around, white women, right, and the role of white women in racism. And I think that those conversations between black women and white women have been very kind of like very painful, but actually very fruitful in a lot of ways to really talk about the legacy that you're talking about, which is like the legacies of like chattel enslavement, right? And chattel enslavement only ended less than 200 years ago. So we still have, generations of people who have, who known people who knew people who were enslaved. So, and then you think about it, the black people in the United States, I've only received a franchise, a vote, less than like, I think like 55 years ago. So I think that, in terms of like historical time, like I think that we're talking about a very short time. But then I think what's really important in terms of like the hopefulness question is like, it's not so much my question about hopefulness. It's a question of what needs to be done. Because really, and I'll be really frank with you, whiteness is killing the planet. Extractive industries, exploitative labor situations. The ability for folks to really not care about the planet that we live on has all rooted in slavery and colonialism. And that's a lot to do with whiteness, right? And white hierarchy and white racism. And so for myself, the question I ask is not a question around what's hopeful, because I think that question around hopefulness is really about keeping white people safe and making white people feel better about themselves. But really the question I want to ask is, like, do we have time? Do we even have time? Do we have, we might not even have until the next election cycle to figure this out, considering that the earth is warming to the point it is. So that to me is a question that I want to ask back to hopefulness. It's good to have hope. We had hope in 2008 with Obama. It didn't really work out as much as we wanted it to. But the question now is, like, do we have time? And the question is, and the answer to that question is, probably not. We got to figure this out quick.
I don't know how much knowledge you have about the situation of policing in Germany, but maybe you have some. And I got your contact through Tahir Della, right? And he has been working with the ISD for a long time on this topic, also.
Absolutely.
In Germany.
Strong brother, I guess.
So my question is, do you see, like, when you look at the situation and the work of initiatives and organization in United States, do you see, like, in your opinion, what would German organizations, what could they be able to learn from organizations and their work in the United States?
Well, I mean, historically, again, I mean, first of all, like, I look at what's happening in Germany and, like, in the solidarity protests that they were organized for the movement of Black Lives in the United States. I look at what's happening in Amsterdam and also in Paris. And I think that Black Europe is the future. I mean, Black Europe is definitely rising in terms of the Black European young people are rising in terms of their own consciousness around the racial situation in Europe. And I think that's a lot of it has been contained within the decolonization movement. I think that, in terms of, like, being able to name the streets, name the communities, name themselves, and obviously, there's a Black feminist overlay there too, because, I mean, one of the prominent activists that went over to Germany was Audre Lorde, the Black feminist lesbian poet, who impacted and almost actually led to the founding of ISD. So I think that, so I think there's a very strong connection between our brothers and sisters in the United States and our brothers and sisters in Germany. And I think that, what I think that to a larger question that you're talking about is that, we can't really say that this fight against racism in the United States, particularly as it relates to the far right, as it kind of manifests in terms of, like, a far right extremism, is not contained in the United States. It certainly spreads its wings to other parts of Europe. And I think that what happened is, and I think that, my sister, Ana Maria, has often said that, what Black Lives Matter has able to do is create a universal hashtag in which, while we might be fighting in different contexts, in different languages, we have this universal hashtag that unites our struggle. So it's not the same struggle, it's a shared struggle. And I think that, once you have a shared struggle, you're able to look across borders and really challenge what's happening in Brazil, in Germany, in Paris, in Amsterdam, in the United States, in Canada, wherever Black people are. And so Black people are being able to unite, and Black people, not just all Black people, but also Black people and their comrades and allies are able to unite under this hashtag, which really gives us power and ability to operate on a global level. So I think that, what we're at right now is that we're at a point of a global movement. And certainly I've seen this, like, from my own experience in terms of, like, recently, just side note, I mean, even in New York, there was a demonstration that was organized for elder who was beaten in Brazil, and there was a demonstration in New York. So what you're seeing is a global phenomenon, not just a local phenomenon.
I talked to somebody else also from Brooklyn, and that he saw also in New York there was like a way, like there was a bigger involvement of especially white young people in the protests around surrounding Black Matters. You talked about like Black Lives Matter and defund the police movements. You talked about it as being, you said this was, there are Black-led protests. But you see there's more involvement. Maybe there's also a difference to former events that took place in the history of United States. I don't know how many times you have been asked the question, what you want white people to understand in the context of something that people nowadays a lot of times refer to as allyship. But is there something you ask from white people in the context of those protests and those works?
You know, I mean, to me, honestly, like, there's a couple of things for me that I look at. I mean, I look at it from perspective of, like, you're not my ally, you're my comrade, and I'm working towards you, we're working together. I think a lot of times allyship has a thing to me personally, because I think that it denotes that, you know, somehow you're doing something nice for me, and we're not doing something together, right? And I think that, you know, I think what has attracted white people to the situation of the Black Lives Matter movement is the fact that there's a level of sympathy and understanding, because, you know, for all of us in the United States, I mean, the economic situation has gotten bad, but generally speaking, the group that's most likely to speak out against it are Black people, right? All Black is Black leadership. And so I think that there was an understanding of that dynamic because of our relationship to the country. But I think that what I would say specifically is that this is not a fad, right? And don't treat it like a fad. Don't treat it like we did this. I marched and that's it. You really need to really sit down and be able to do the work, right? And doing the work means both in terms of the protest work, but also understanding the situation that, you know, this racism that we're facing is rooted in capitalism, is rooted in private property. So that means you have to really challenge the fact that how you show up in the world in terms of inheritance, in terms of your own, quote unquote privilege or class position, but also work together with people around the world to fight against it. You know, and so, you know, and like, you know, and work as a comrade. So that's where I think it's going to be kind of like where things are moving right now. But I think that one thing that I'm really happy about is that once people start to move together, people start to like feel their own strength. And I was in Brooklyn this summer. I hung out in the streets. And I say that after 2 to 3 months of protest, the people felt stronger. The people felt more confident. And I think that there was a level of beauty in that when you saw in the aftermath of these protests, more men and women kind of holding hands, more men and men holding hands. I think that, you know, you can't really talk about protests without talking about the act of love, right? And like, you know, and like once you bust through the door with a protest, there's all sorts of different feelings come out and all sorts of different emotions come out. And one of them is really love. And so I'm really happy at this moment. And I really want to say that I'm really proud of the young people and the young people who've been taking the leadership here, because it has been young people who've been doing that. And like, you know, James Baldwin once said, we must come together like lovers to create our country. And I think that that's what we've seen in the streets to this day. But as much as I do, Jacob, love is fight. You get into arguments. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So you know what I'm saying? So hold space to yell at each other, hold space to get mad at each other, hold space for a misunderstanding, but don't lose the vision, right? The vision needs to be another society, another country.